This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise. This week on Sea Change Radio, the second half of our 10-year anniversary celebration, where we hear from some of the planet's most important thinkers, leading green advocates, and sustainability innovators. Stay tuned to hear excerpts from interviews with thought leaders like George Monbiot, politicians like Gavin Newsom, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists like Robin McDowell, and scientists like Richard Lund. We start out with Paul Hawken, one of the most enlightened minds of the environmental movement, who talks about the delicate balance we must strike in taking care of ourselves and also taking care of the planet. In 1993, you wrote The Ecology of Commerce, over 20 years ago, and I read this quote that you had pulled out from John Kenneth Galbraith. The expurgated quote is, "The modern conservative is engaged in the search for a superior moral justification for selfishness." Reflecting on 20 years from now, can we overcome that instinct towards selfishness? That instinct of, well, I earn this, so I get to use it however I see fit.
I don't think we'll ever overcome that instinct. I think what we can change is the definition of self.
Into?
Well, you're myself. I mean, when we understand the self is just a complete figment of the imagination, it doesn't exist, then our selfishness actually becomes a way to improve the lives of all living beings around us, because they're our self as well. It really has to be experiential. You have to have that breakthrough, that understanding that, you know, that wow, whoa, whoa. You cannot teach that. You can talk about it until the cows come home, but unless you actually have that experience, then it's a concept. You can act based upon the concept, and that is a very, very good thing to do. But when you have that moment, and it only takes a moment, it only takes a second to see that and to experience that, then you still have to take care of yourself in the sense of, you know, if you don't take care of yourself, you can't take care of anything else. But taking care of yourself is very, very different than accumulation. It's very, very different than taking care of yourself at the expense of others. It's very different in terms of taking that which doesn't belong to you. It's very different than not knowing the impact, the implication of what you buy, what you invest in, what you drive, how you, you know, function in the world, you know. And if you basically shudder, constrain, put blinders on yourself, then you can cruise through the world and do great harm without knowing it. But once you take those off, you can't do it, because it's you.
Next, we hear from journalist Robin McDowell, who won the Pulitzer Prize for her team's life-saving work in exposing the horrors of slavery in the fishing industry in Southeast Asia.
We were looking at the Thai fishing industry, which is a $7 billion a year export industry, and one of the biggest markets is the United States. So basically what had happened over the years in Thailand was, as the fish stocks were being depleted closer to home, they were going farther and farther out to sea. So their waters were going elsewhere in Southeast Asia and South Asia and even as far as Africa. So in order to meet the demands, the labor demands, they started recruiting more aggressively migrant workers from Myanmar, Cambodia, and Laos. In this case, you know, recruiting them meant, in some cases, kidnapping them, selling them onto boats, or tricking them. So that's basically what happened. It was a shortage of labor, and they were looking elsewhere to fill that gap.
And how did you find them on this Indonesian island? Was there just one island where these slaves were kept?
Well, what happened was my colleague Margie Mason had a very good source in Jakarta. That's where she's based with AP. And he was talking about a large number of fishermen who were stranded on islands in eastern Indonesia.
And what was the extent of the problem once you got there?
Basically, these men were desperate to talk. When they realized that we were journalists and we were there to tell their stories, they couldn't wait to talk. They would chase after us with, you know, like little pieces of paper and jam them in our pockets. Their main concern was that they hadn't seen families for 5, 10, sometimes 20 years, and that they thought that they were dead. They were really trapped on this island and for months, sometimes years at a time on these boats. The conditions were horrific, much worse than we had really realized. They were working, in some cases, 22 to 24 hours a day. They would get, you know, an hour's sleep, and then they'd be up at it again. They'd be beaten if they were caught trying to get rest with the tails of stingrays. Basically just forced to haul these nets, which are several tons, and just pull them up and then spend the next, you know, 8 hours sorting the fish that are spilt out over the entire, you know, deck of the boat, a couple feet high. And then by the time they finished, the nets would be filled again. So it would go on and on like this. It was just really, really like some of the worst conditions that you can imagine at sea.
Now let's hear from another important environmentalist and author, George Monbiot, as he discusses the important role that the commons plays in helping create vibrant, functional cities.
You talk about extending the commons, and I've heard of that, but I had never heard this term, which I really liked, was public luxuries. Maybe you could explain what that means.
Yes, well, you see, in our cities and in most parts of the world, there is loads of space for us all to live in luxury if we live with public luxury. We can build fantastic parks. We can build wonderful amenities where we can all play great sports because there's enough amenities, where we can all have amazing entertainment. But if we try to do it all through private luxury, if everybody tries to have their own tennis court or their own huge home cinema and their own sort of garden like a park, well, there's simply no room. There is not space to have functional cities, cities which don't sprawl all over the land and basically fall apart as a result, while everybody is seeking private luxury. But we can do it through public luxury. And combining that notion of public luxury with community control, where the community actually is in charge of what happens and receives through land value taxation significant income from those crucial resources, which it can then redistribute either as a basic income or by building those amenities, or it can buy land and start building social housing and whatever else is needed, then you start to make sense of community. But at the same time, you've got to operate at the government scale as well, and we need changes of government. And I think the sort of thing that Becky Bond and Zach Exley, who you've had on, are talking about with the big organizing model they used in the Sanders campaign has got enormous potential.
As listeners know, we always like to highlight sustainability innovators on Sea Change Radio. Let's listen to a bit of Erica and Colin Angle talk about how they've engineered robots in service of saving coral reefs by ridding them of the invasive lionfish.
So what problem is RISE trying to solve? Why don't you explain the mission of your organization, if you will?
Robots in Service of the Environment, RISE, is an organization designed to use low-cost robotic technology to solve serious environmental problems. And our first problem that we're addressing is the lionfish invasive species problem here on the Atlantic seaboard. The challenge, this is an invasive species. It came from the Pacific. It has no natural predators, and it lays thousands of eggs every few days, and it has, again, the population is getting just out of control, and they eat all the juvenile fish around the reefs. And without these juvenile fish to eat the algae blooms, the reefs die, and we have a huge ecological disaster. And so the problem is, how do we address this without causing a bigger problem of trying to introduce some type of predator, which never ends well, or using chemicals, which can be, again, have horrible consequences beyond that which was intended. And we're designing a robot that is cheap enough that we could deploy it at scale and have a robot catch sort of more than its value in lionfish, so a fisherman would actually be interested in using these robots to enhance their catch. And the lionfish are good to eat. One of our mottos is you have to eat them to beat them. And so that is one dimension of RISE. And the other is to tell everyone about what we're doing.
So one of my passions is in education. I run a nonprofit called Science from Scientists, which sends scientists into classrooms to educate students in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. And so much of the content and material that is A, going to be generated from the various missions of the robot, but also just the general concepts, whether it be from ocean health to reef health to invasive species. There's just so much educational content that piggybacks very well with curriculum relevance in the classrooms, and you know what kids don't love learning about oceans. So it was sort of a natural pairing of both the robotic technology side and then bringing this content and really neat material into the classroom to inspire future generations, which are really, you know, going to be out there trying to save our planet.
Gavin Newsom will most likely be California's next governor. We now hear a bit of his 2016 interview, where he paints a hopeful picture of the future of the environmental movement.
One of the philosophical differences I saw throughout this campaign that I think had a lot of us shaking our heads was being able to promise the moon, but not ask for any sacrifice. You read any article about California's clean energy proposals, and they're like, will it lead to higher electricity costs? Will it lead to higher gas prices? There's not a lot of sacrifice. How does a politician, like yourself, call it like it is and ask an electorate that's been fed for the last 40 years endless tax cuts with endless growth as this kind of magical thinking? How do we get past that? Because we need more than magical thinking to really make these changes.
No, I think, well, this is going to be the challenge of the Trump administration, right? Is to follow through on everything they promoted and somehow suggest they go back to a world that no longer exists and they're going to have abundant coal. When it comes to the environment, I don't see it as a massive sacrifice. I really don't. It's kind of, for me, like the Olympics. Even if you don't make it on the team, you're going to be a lot healthier. Meaning, even if you don't actually achieve your goals, the economy is going to be healthier because we're going to be, by definition, more efficient. We'll have a more sustainable mindset, less situational. It will force innovation. It will force behavioral change that ultimately, I think, will inure more favorably long-term. So even if there's some short-term friction in terms of that change, I don't see it as the kind of trade-off that some suggest. I think we've proven, again, the tyranny of or can be replaced with the genius of and, that you can do certain things and, as you change behavior and animate better behavior, and actually produce more positive outcomes. My point is this: per unit, the cost of energy may be higher in California, but because of our energy efficiency, your bill actually can be a little bit lower. That we can transition from dirty fuels, and as we transition, create real jobs and opportunity with large-scale solar plants and solar thermal and geothermal strategies and rooftop solar, and actually paint a brighter picture. And so I've seen the argument for sacrifice, but I think when it comes to environmental sustainability, environmental stewardship, I'm not convinced that we have to be so pessimistic about those trade-offs. What I'm about to say couldn't mean the world's disaster, could change your joy and laughter to tears and
this is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. To celebrate the show's 10th anniversary, we're highlighting some of our best moments of the past decade. Of course, you can hear all of these interviews for free in their entirety in our archives at seachangeradio.com. Next, let's listen to Professor Richard Lunt describe the tremendous potential of transparent solar cells.
The basic idea for it is you take a piece of plastic and you embed in that piece of plastic or piece of glass a colorful dye that absorbs a small fraction of the visible light of the solar spectrum. And then it converts that energy into glowing light at another wavelength. So there's this color to these systems because of the absorptive filtering and because of the colorful glow. But that glowing light then gets waveguided or trapped in the plastic, just like a fiber optic. And it guides that energy to the edge of that plate where you mount a very thin strip of your expensive solar cell. And that light is then converted into electricity. And so the luminescent solar concentrator was a way to really lower the cost of these kinds of things. And there was some thought about using these kinds of systems as windows, but they're very colorful and very bright. If I could show you one of them, in your window, if you sit behind it, it's kind of like working in a disco.
Right. Not ideal for all business no. scenes.
And at the worst, it kind of makes the room, it makes it look like it's doomsday. What we've really been working on developing is a new way to make these where we can selectively harvest the parts of the solar spectrum that we can't see with our eye, namely the ultraviolet and infrared parts of the solar spectrum, allowing the visible light to pass through. And then these molecules glow at another invisible wavelength, trapping that light and guiding it around the edge. And so because we're not absorbing or glowing visible light, these systems look exceptionally clear and transparent to the eye, just like a typical piece of glass or plastic.
And why is this important to have a transparent luminescent solar concentrator? Where could some of the applications be?
Right. So I think once you realize that you can make devices like this, it actually really sparks the imagination. We have a lot of people that sort of email us on a daily basis with lots of ideas about where they want to integrate these kinds of things. But there's lots of places where you can start to think about deploying this kind of solar harvesting system. Anywhere where there's glass, in windows, in tall buildings and sunroofs, skylights and greenhouses. You could think about integrating them even in mobile electronics to extend the battery life or make them so that, you don't have to plug them in. So you could even think about integrating it into automobiles, whether it's in the windshields and the windows or even around the siding. And likewise, you could think about integrating this in billboards or any kind of display. So the applications are almost endless. It's really exciting. And so it can really turn our electronics and our cities into solar farms.
One of the more influential thinkers in the area of progressive political messaging is Berkeley Professor of Linguistics George Lakoff. Let's hear Dr. Lakoff discuss how conservative minds view the concept of public and private ownership.
Okay, so let's take the importance of proper language framing and relate it to environmentalism. Connect the dots, if you will.
And what does this have to do with environmentalism? Everything. First of all, take liberty. Suppose you want to build a motel on a wetland. You want to fill in the wetland and build the motel, and you've bought the land. It's your land. The land is yours to use. Why can't you fill in the wetland and build a motel? It would be, they would find it immoral for a government to stop you from doing that. And the same thing is true with any use of what is called private property, because land is seen as private property, there for anybody to use. Minerals are there as, things to be bought and sold. In law, property law, there are certain metaphors for property. Property is a bundle of rights, and there are four rights. They are the right of transfer, you can sell it. The right of access, you can access it. The right of use, you can use it for your benefit. And the right of extraction, you can extract oil, water, whatever from it and sell it, right? Those are your bundle of rights with property. And they see that as, natural, that nature is there for them, for their liberty, and that democracy and government is there to promote their liberty in doing whatever. Now, this goes against everything that environmentalists know first. Every time you try to do anything that has to do with protecting the environment, it's probably going to interfere with the liberty of some corporation or some individuals. And it's going to interfere with even the idea of liberty. So even if you're poor, you're going to vote against your own interests because you want to be a strict father in your own domain. You have those values.
As Thomas Frank and What's the Matter with Kansas really clearly was able to set forth, and this is like these people who had no vested interest in seeing X, Y, or Z enacted would somehow go along with these policies which were not helpful for their personal gain in any way.
Right, but there's a brain-based explanation for this, and that's what it is.
Now, let's hear Rolling Stone reporter Tim Dickinson explain why Florida, despite being the Sunshine State, lags so far behind in terms of residential solar.
So how does Florida rank 16th in solar power production when it is the Sunshine State?
It's this amazing paradox, right? I mean, and it's actually much worse than it sounds. California is the runaway solar giant at like 10 gigawatts and followed by Arizona at about 2 gigawatts. And then it really trails off after that. And Florida drags in, I think right now after Massachusetts, certainly New Jersey, and I think even Connecticut has snuck in front of it. So just to give you a sense of it's an amazing laggard despite having the third best rooftop solar potential in the country and the best solarity east of the Mississippi, obviously, just given its southern latitude. So the reason that Florida is not a solar producer has everything to do with the political sway of the utilities, the monopoly utilities in Tallahassee, and sort of the utilities' grip on the political process down there. The sort of key policies that have allowed solar to explode elsewhere are either absent or actually illegal in Florida. So there is no, unlike even in conservative places like Texas, there's no renewable energy portfolio standard. So there's no a requirement that Florida generate any portion of its electrical generation from renewable sources. So that's really an outlier. And then it turns out that it's actually illegal for third parties to operate in the state as sellers of electricity. So what that does is it says that companies like SolarCity and Sunrun can't come in and lease you the solar power. You know, these popular leasing programs, basically, where you can get solar panels on your rooftop for no money down. You know, that's kind of been the model that's unlocked solar for hundreds of thousands of households across the country. That business model is actually illegal in Florida.
When the sun shines, they slip into the shade. Drink their lemonade. When the sun shines, when the sun shines,
this is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. To celebrate the show's 10th anniversary, we're highlighting some of our best moments of the past half decade. Of course, you can hear all of these interviews for free in their entirety in our archives at seachangeradio.com. Next, let's look at an innovation in solar panels which transforms humidity into drinking water with Zero Mass Water CEO and founder Cody Friesen.
So Zero Mass Water is a very intriguing idea. Why don't you spell out the basics for our listeners in terms of the technology?
Sure. Well, we founded Zero Mass Water to just change people's relationship with water and really to sort of perfect water for every person, every place. I think most people appreciate that water is sort of imperfect everywhere. In the U.S., we have something like 1.2 million miles of lead pipes that are going to take over $1 trillion to replace, and 750 water main breaks a day. And that's just here domestically. And when we think about globally, you're talking about one person dying from waterborne illness every 10 seconds. And so when we think about technology leapfrogging all sorts of challenges, whether it's communication or information or energy, those are now happening today. And up till now, water sort of didn't have that leapfrog.
Describe your hydro panel technology if you can.
Yeah, so Source is, as you indicated, a hydro panel. And that name is intended to signify that it's a solar panel. It looks very much like a traditional solar panel for electricity, but it does something very different, which is it takes sunlight and air and produces perfect drinking water effectively anywhere on the planet. And it does so entirely independent of infrastructure, right? So no pipe connection coming in, no electrical connection coming in, only the water vapor in the air and sunlight powering it to make up to basically in a standard two-panel array that we would put on a house in the U.S., up to a case of bottled water a day. So a lot of drinking water from a relatively small footprint. And the panels themselves, Source panels, produce pure water that we then mineralize to basically perfect the taste and healthfulness of the water that we are producing.
To close out the show, let's turn to David Rolfe, a longtime labor union leader from SEIU, as he discusses the future of work, the need for a higher minimum wage, and how creating a strong middle class is ultimately a sustainability issue.
Why is this a sustainability issue, talking about the future of work? We always hear about green jobs and the green economy, David, but how does the struggle of low-income workers connect to sustainability?
My view is that our country at this moment in time faces three key generational challenges, and those challenges are the erosion of the middle class and the decline of the American dream, the corruption of our democracy, and the toxification of our environment and destruction of our environment. And I think those are all linked together. Generally speaking, environmental damage and environmental destruction wreaks havoc first on the poorest communities and the lowest wage communities. In turn, though, people who are hungry or who can't afford the basic necessities of life are unlikely to prioritize sustainability as their first priority in the way they make choices as consumers. They're going to prioritize price. They're going to prioritize convenience if they are overworked or if they are experiencing economic stress. So paradoxically, although environmental damage is most likely to have its first and worst impacts on low-income communities, communities of color, and working-class communities, those are often the communities that have the fewest tools to fight back, and that should, if they were instead members of a prosperous middle class, would have both the time and resources to invest in a more sustainable set of choices than are available to many, many people who live on low incomes.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Young Holt Unlimited, Stevie Wonder, and Greg Allman. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.